What's up and welcome to the Invincibly Broken Podcast, a weekly talk show hosted by your boys, Orlando and Julian, talking about today's society, their family lives, and anything they damn well please. So sit back, relax, turn up the volume, and enjoy the show. What's up and welcome to another episode of the Invincibly Broken Podcast. I am your host, Orlando, and as always, joined with my wonderful, beautiful, amazingly amazing person, because that's all I have for today, Julian. Julian, say hello.
Hello, everybody. I know usually I come up with like just one hello, but I just want to welcome you guys to the first
new year, new year, new you, Julian.
I'm trying to turn over a new leaf and starting to be a little
I'm impressed. You shocked me because we didn't rehearse this. Like you
can
More than one word. That's great, man.
And,
I like
and
it.
And welcome to the first episode of the already dumpster fire, which is 2021.
Absolutely. So happy new year to every, to all of our listeners out there, and happy new year and excuse me, happy holidays for all of you who have celebrated your holiday or are currently celebrating. I think it's Christmas in Serbia right now. Don't ask me why I know that. I think I read it in the back of a Snapple cap, but hey guys, thank you so much. We're super excited. We have, as promised, we have a lot of plans for expanding on our interview series for the Invincibly Broken Podcast, trying to bring you exciting people to learn about their lives and what they do for a living and how they affect other people. But before we get started, just so you know, we are currently live. This is broadcasted on YouTube and on Facebook. So please take a second, hit the like button below. And hit the subscribe button, set up the alert so you know when we go live as well. And please interact with us. If you have a question for myself or Julian or our guests, please throw it in a little chat. We're more than happy to try to answer your questions as we go. Also, this broadcast will also be available on our podcast that'll launch next week. So you'll be able to, as long as you search the Invincibly Broken Podcast, we're on all podcasting platforms. But with no further ado, guys, I really want to take an opportunity to introduce our guest this week. This gentleman comes from us from Pittsburgh, right? And he is a life coach, an actor. He's a personal trainer as well. He's also working on his own podcast currently, has some really, which I thought was a fascinating story, as well as working on some really cool content for people out there. Please join us in welcoming John Scheschler Jr.
You pronounced that very good, Orlando. That was awesome.
I try. I beat that. I really do, because people beat up my last name all the time.
Yeah. What's up, guys?
Nah, man. What's up with you? Please tell our listeners a little bit about John, Trainer John. I know I seen that little tagline that you have, a little James Bond thing you got going.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, so I'm a storyteller. So my whole life, I kind of look at as a bunch of stories jammed side by side. So I grew up in Pittsburgh, and I am a personal trainer. I'm a gym manager. I'm a life coach. I am kind of a jack of all trades at this point. So what I'm trying to work on right now with, my new podcast, the Man Alive podcast, that's set to debut at the end of this month. Okay. Basically, it's just to get awareness for men's health and men's issues, because I think that's something that I think we can all kind of say that a lot of guys really don't take care of. They don't look at their health. And, that's just something that gets pushed by the wayside just because, well, something's hurting, but I don't need to go to see a doctor for it. Yeah. I mean, we all know that's bull crap. I mean, we all need to think about our longevity.
And a lot of it has to do with the fact that men have this tendency to think that we are made of steel, that we're invincible.
Yeah.
We can't be broken. Obviously, play on words for our podcast, but you know, it's important. You know, the days of having to keep it all in until you burst, or trying to carry the weight of the world on your shoulders, regardless of whether it's your job, your personal life, your family life, and not being able to show emotion—it's crazy. And you know, Julie and I talk about this all the time. Being, especially since we are both Hispanic and we're raised with that Hispanic bravado that you have to be tough and mm-hmm. you know, suck it up and whatnot. But I'll tell you, we'll be the first ones, both of us. We don't mess around with our health anymore. Once you pass that threshold of your late 20s, you're like, shit doesn't work the same way as it used to.
Yeah. Oh yeah, totally. And like for me, like you heard when I was on Foley's podcast. Mm-hmm. And so I've been a medical disaster for ever. So like,
I think it's good to mention real quick. Let's give a shout out to John Foley for Men's Methodology. We had him on the show before, and this is actually how we found John. We heard his story, and his story is extremely captivating. So I'm going to let you go ahead and please tell us, start from wherever you want to start.
Sure. I will try and make this not as boring as I can. So, in 1992, I was 10 years old. So, don't laugh, Julian. It's a really good story.
It's not that I don't know. Unfortunately, I don't have the availability of an independent office.
Okay. So
I do have a 5-year-old and a wife passing by, pressing like a little sign to me saying, speak.
It's all right. But anyway, so in 92, in June of 92, so I was out playing with some buddies of mine, and then I came home and I complained that I had a headache. So I laid down and I took a nap and got back up, and I felt worse than I did when I had laid down to take a nap. So took my temperature, was about 105, 106-ish.
How old were you at this time?
I was 10.
Okay.
Yeah. So obviously my parents were concerned, what's going on? So we went to the emergency room. So when we get to the emergency room, they ran some tests and they said, there's basically nothing we can do for you here. We're not equipped for running certain tests that we need to run. So we're going to life flight you down to Children's Hospital in Pittsburgh. So they get me on a gurney, they board me on this helicopter, and away I go. So while I'm being life flighted to Children's Hospital, I fall into a coma.
Okay.
So I stay in this coma for about 6 weeks. So after the 6 weeks were up, and I started to slowly come out of the coma. And I don't know if you're familiar with people who come out of comas, or you're familiar with like how people wake up. It's not like you see on TV. So
no,
it's
I was about to say the most experience I have is, I think, a Steven Seagal movie that I've seen. He comes out of a coma. He kicks the crap out of everybody.
Yeah, right. It's totally not like that. So like for like maybe like a week, you might like move a finger and like it gradually gets better.
You're not using your muscles at all, right?
Like, yeah, exactly. So once I woke up fully, I was just a body in a bed. So I couldn't walk, talk, eat, basically do everything except just lie there. And memory wise, it's a little bit foggy, but from what I can piece together, I had a tracheostomy. So that's where they cut a hole in your neck and they put a breathing tube down it. So I was on a ventilator for a while. Wow. And I had feeding tube stuck in me. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. So
life of the party.
Oh God. Yeah. It was great. It was great.
So let me ask you a couple questions. And I know it's foggy. It's many years ago that this happened to you. But
right.
So you're a 10-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. You get this fever. You don't feel well. And then all of a sudden you're being airlifted to another hospital. But what was going on through your mind like at that time?
Honestly, Orlando, I have no recollection really. Wow. All of that whole process. That's kind of how, I guess, intense it was. So I get to the emergency room and basically that's it. All my memories from that point on kind of are wiped. So
I gotta ask because I like you said, the only thing I know about is movies and comas.
Yeah. But right.
Do you have recollection when you were under your coma? Like, was it one of those things where like you hear stuff? Did you dream? Was it just blankness till you woke up?
Yeah, I get asked this a lot.
I'm sure.
I mean, it's been 30 years, so if I did, I'm not gonna remember it. I would more than likely say, yeah, I probably did hear some sounds or have some really spaced out dreams or, you know, stuff like that. But everybody's case is different. So, there's no like rubric that says you're in a coma. This is what you're going to experience. So,
unless you're Steven Seagal.
Unless you're Steven Seagal, and then you have a script to go by, So I was at the Children's Hospital for 6 weeks, and then I was getting poked and prodded, and you know, tests after tests, and they didn't really know what was going on. Mm-hmm. Basically, what they kind of came down with was I had something neurological going on. So it was affecting my nervous system, but they really couldn't pinpoint what it was specifically. So after Children's Hospital, I got transferred to, it's called the Children's Institute in Pittsburgh. So basically, when I got there, I was in isolation for 30 days. So basically, isolation means nobody enters your room. Except the nurses.
What was the reason for the isolation? Was there?
So for the isolation, for what I understand, the protocol for them was anybody who had like a tracheostomy or some sort of disorder that they really didn't know if it was contagious or things like that. That was just their protocol. So basically, I was in a room with a TV and all my equipment that kind of kept me alive, and a whole bunch of Simpsons videos. So
at least you have good taste. I mean, wait, did you choose the Simpsons video, or they gave you?
I did.
Okay, all right.
So it's all good. But being in isolation is definitely a very humbling experience because you have no outside contact other than the medical staff. And I think my parents were allowed in, but they had to gown up with PPE and all that fun stuff.
For a 10-year-old boy, that's crazy.
It's a lot.
Lot. I mean, I was in isolation when I went through my radiation treatment, and I was a 30-year-old man, and I was freaking out being alone for 2 weeks. I couldn't imagine being being a young boy and not even really understanding why you're there, right? Because you said they still didn't know what was wrong with you.
Yeah, exactly.
It wasn't like they were like, "Hey, you got to do this for a few weeks, and then you're going to be good. You get to go home and go play with your Transformers." They were just like, everybody's just shrugging their shoulders and like, "Oh, we don't."
And it was weird because like it was this big question mark, like, what does he have? And, you know, what tests do we run? And, you know, things like that. So they finally, after a couple more weeks of testing and things like that, they came to a conclusion with a disorder. It's called Guillain-Barré syndrome. So basically, go ahead.
No, I was repeating it back to you.
Okay. Go ahead. So basically what Guillain-Barré syndrome is, it is a neurological disorder where it affects a quadrant of the body. In my case, everything from the neck down. So everything from the neck down was wiped out. So I was in a wheelchair. I was on a liquid diet. I couldn't talk. So I basically had to either write. I couldn't even write things down.
So you had you had complete paralysis from the neck down.
That's correct.
So you got that high fever. Were you paralyzed then? Like during the trip to the hospital, or this is after you had actually went to the coma after you woke up?
So this is after the coma. Okay. So once I woke up from the coma and like I finally, you know, figured out that okay, this is not working. So when I got to the Children's Institute and they finally said, well, this is what we think he has. Mm-hmm. They kick-started physical therapy, occupational therapy for my fine motor skills, speech-language therapy. They hooked me up with a dietitian, neurologist, you name it. I had to go see these doctors. And so for me, what I remember, the hardest thing for me to do was obviously regain my physical abilities. So knowing how to walk and then not having control of your legs and then having to work over these muscles and strengthening them and just dealing with nervous system issues and muscle spasms and things like that, that definitely was the hardest part. And in addition to not being able to talk, so trying to communicate with my therapists and, you know, other medical teams about, you know, this hurts and don't do that, and, you know, things like that. So I was in the Children's Institute probably for about another 4 or 5 months. And then I got to a base functioning level where they're like, okay, we're going to discharge you because we think that you're at a good point to where we feel comfortable doing that. So after I got home, then I had to readjust to going back to school, seeing my friends and answering questions. Well, where did you go? And what happened? And things like that. It's a huge adjustment for a 10-year-old.
And with that being said, John, you know, you mentioned going back to school. I mean, I got it. You were in the hospital and you started to regain your motor functions and everything. So talk to me a little bit about when you went back to school, because I know, obviously, because we all in here were at one point, 10-year-old, 11, 12-year-old kids, especially boys, in the 90s were brutal.
Yes, they were.
So did you, especially knowing that I had my friends, everything was cool, I was gone for X amount of time, and now I'm in the condition, were you subjected to like a lot of bullying? Or did you actually, well, in Pittsburgh, never mind. So yeah, you probably were.
Actually, no.
You got down.
No, wasn't anything like that. So when I went back to school, I didn't go back to my original elementary school. Okay. I had to go to another school in the district that had a program for students that had disabilities like mine. So I was there for probably about 4 or 5 months just to kind of get reacclimated into, you know, going back to class and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Were you in a wheelchair, like, or using anything assistive to help you walk?
No, I think what I had was I had like a cane if I needed it, but it was just there if my back got tired or, you know, something like that. So once I got back to my original elementary school, that's when reality for me kind of set in. because everybody was like, where'd you go? And, you know, everybody, and it wasn't like I was, you know, bullied or anything like that. Everybody kind of treated me like I was broken. Which is kind of understandable because I basically was kind of broken. So everybody was just kind of like, we don't know how to treat you. Which is totally understandable because at 10, you really aren't exposed to other kids who are in a wheelchair. They've been in a hospital for X amount of time. So when I re-entered school, they enrolled me in a special education program because they just weren't sure if I had intelligence loss or I had some things that I needed to work on, which I did.
Okay.
So I had a math deficiency. I couldn't really remember how to compute numbers. And at that point, I was in fifth grade. So they were working on algebra in the mainstream classes. Well, there's no way I could have done that at that point. So, so aside from doing special education math, I was also doing special education English. So for me, it was I guess this is where the whole masculinity thing comes in, even at that age, because for me, it was like, I don't want to be labeled as somebody who's in special education.
Absolutely. I mean, like, even especially in the 90s, like, right? Like, like, it was like, don't you, like, the jokes back then was like the short bus jokes, you know, there wasn't an autism diagnosis, you know, it was the term. I mean, not to offend anybody, but the term was that the retard kids, right?
Yeah.
Like, you didn't want to be with that group, labeled as that group, because you were in a slower class or because they were in a specific environment to help them excel. And it was excluded from everybody else. So I can totally see why, you know, you were like, well, what the hell? I'm normal. Like, why am I here?
Yeah, exactly. And everything that I did go through, like, even when I went back to school, I was like, I feel normal, but I know I'm not because I've got lower back issues. I've got a scar on my neck. I've got, you know, all these reminders that I've just went through basically hell and back to be here. So the kids weren't bullies. That, like, that never came into the equation. Like I said, it was more or less like they treated me like I was broken to a point, and they really didn't know how to interact with
me. So it was more like a mild neglect.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But it wasn't done on purpose.
There was no malice behind it, but it was kind of like, you know, like nothing compared to what you went through. But, you know, I broke my leg, like I destroyed, shattered my leg almost 6 years ago. And I was at home with my leg up. And, you know, for everything, my wife was like, oh, let me move. I'm like, I'm good. Yeah. I'm okay. But, you know, it's that fear that you're going to cause pain or discomfort to the other person. I mean.
So John, with that being said, that, you know, thankfully, you weren't bullied, right? I mean, I can't say that many children in your situation probably, you know, didn't go through something like that. But that being treated that way, did you feel that it helped you through your recuperating and rehab, or did it hinder you? Like, what was your mental state? Were you like, this sucks, I hate my life, nobody wants to be my friend? Or were you like, nah, fuck this, I'm gonna use this as motivation to get better?
So I'm not gonna lie, it was more of, this sucks, I hate this, I want to be normal. And I remember saying that exact phrase a million and one
times. I'm sure. Especially for a child, that's what any kid wants, is just to have a normal life.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely. The other part of like, I'm going to use this as, you know, something positive. That came a lot later. That came when I, you know, became an adult.
Yeah.
So this whole pity me, pity party for myself. Yeah. I had that for, probably up until I turned 18, 19. Yeah, because I couldn't, even when I got into high school, I couldn't do things that my peers could. I wanted to do sports, but I couldn't, just because of my physical limitations. So I, you know, did the easier extracurricular activities. I acted. I, you know, I did creative things like photography and write for the newspaper and journalism, things like that.
Nothing wrong with photography.
No, not at all. I love it. Yeah. It's a good stress reliever. So,
So did you now, since you mentioned that you went into other extracurricular activities that weren't streamline sports, because I know I have a passion for photography. I never did photography in high school because it was like a bitch thing to do. Like you had to play sports like baseball, right, or college, you know what I mean? So is that when you found that people were starting to, was that like a pivotal point in your life because your interests were moving different ways because not because you wanted to, because you had to, because you're, I mean, I'm assuming as a child, you were trying to figure out different ways to, you know, not fit in, but like for yourself, like to build skills and be part of groups and meet new friends and things like that.
Right. It was partly because I wanted to do that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I had an interest in being creative. I always liked writing. I always liked, you know, taking pictures, capturing the moments and things like that. So I had an interest in it. But on the flip side, I was always like, I want to do something that is a little bit more, you know, jockish, I guess, for lack of a better term. So it's like, you don't get a lot of like friends if you, you know, go around and take pictures and, you know, write newspaper articles and things like that.
If you were a teenager now, you would have been the man because would have been on point.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But then, then the whole, you know, sexuality stuff comes in.
Okay.
And then, like, that adds a whole other layer.
So when was this in the process?
So, John, I'm sorry to cut you guys, the both of you off. Before you continue, I just have one curiosity. So you went through all that and you went through this. So now, 30 years later, are you still dealing with like after effects of what you went through? Or, you know, I mean, because you're a personal trainer, I'm like, okay, that's definitely one way of attacking a, I don't want to say shortcoming, but I guess in this case, a disability head on doing the exact opposite.
Right.
So, but are you still kind of dealing with after effects or lingering effects or can,
oh, you know. God, yes. Every single day. So I suffer from chronic lower back pain that I have it every single day. So I see a chiropractor once a week to just get adjusted, you know, get the kinks out and everything like that. I do have muscle spasms every night when I go to sleep. Wow. It's freaking annoying.
That's gotta be a pain because I've had most, some of the, and sometimes it's really painful depending on where it is.
Yeah. So,
and what about since it was neurological, you know, dealing with your nervous system, do you ever like get like numbness or maybe even like a partial paralysis?
So not partial paralysis, but like a couple years ago, I went and saw an infectious disease doctor because I was experiencing things like nerve pain in my chest and, you know, my arms and my legs, but I really wasn't sure. I'm like, where the hell is this coming from? So I went and saw him. He did a couple blood tests, and basically it was just like residual effects from the illness that I had as a kid. So
this is still labeled whatever that was called, because I totally forgot. No, I didn't forget the name. I just can't pronounce it.
Yeah, basically. So, okay. Basically what they did was they gave me a 12-day round of this this drug. It was called Rocephin. So basically after that 12 days, the nerve pain kind of dissipated. Okay. So I haven't had any issues with that since, knock on wood.
So I have, I'm sorry, we didn't mean to cut you off, but I literally have like,
no, you're good.
I think I have a trillion questions, but let's dig in a little bit deeper. You mentioned your sexuality, which I'm sure, I mean, I'm interested. I mean, I don't know how the hell your opening statement was. I'm going to try to tell you this story without boring you, because I had to move up to the edge of my seat so I could, because I'm literally it's just, when I first heard your story, I literally wanted to ask you like 3,000 questions. So I was like, I even remember.
You asked me all the questions.
Yeah, I remember messaging Julian. I'm like, we need to have this guy on our show because I want to know. Yeah. I got to get him on. So let's talk about your sexuality.
Right.
Let's focus on where it really started, because look, you're a 10-year-old boy. You get sick. You're in a coma. Now you're going back to school. Is this something that you started early on? Later, talk to us. What was going on with you?
So it didn't start early on. Mm-hmm. So it probably started like junior, senior year of high school. And mm-hmm. at that point, especially in like the late 90s, mm-hmm. it was like, it wasn't the best thing to be. So
unless you were Pedro from Real World.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And like that was like the only role model that mm-hmm. I had. So mm-hmm. like, and really his story, yeah, it was great, but he died. So like that's what I had to look forward to. So
he went to my middle school.
Are you serious? Really?
I didn't know that.
My health teacher was his health teacher, and when he passed away, it was like a big thing. I was raised in Miami.
Oh. Yeah. Oh my God, that's so cool.
Pedro Zamora.
Yep. Wow. But like it's one of those things where like if you dissociate with the behavior and you just drive, like men are good at this. We just drive everything down and we don't recognize it. It's gonna go away. That's bullshit. We all know that. So it's
Yeah, and I'm very curious. I'm going to let you go on, but once you stop, let me ask you, because I'm very curious to ask you a question. So please go on, but just know that I have a question pending.
All right.
Go ahead.
All right. All right. So when I entered college, I went to Penn State University. So it's this, I mean, you guys know, it's this huge, huge university with people from all over the world, and they're all
lines.
Yes. And
of academics and sports.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So like it's a culture shock too, because you're in classes with all these kids from everywhere in the world. They're speaking different languages and they look certain ways. And you know, like college is a time to experiment, right? So mm-hmm. So like I didn't. Which, you know, I'm kind of happy I did, mm-hmm. just for, you know, safety reasons, mm-hmm. you know, things like that. But I did talk to a lot of people. I was dubbed Mr. Penn State by one of the administrators because I basically did everything social on that campus. The friends that I had who were out at that point, it was like they were still not out, because it was like almost like, well, if I tell people, then I'm going to get bullied even more. And I'm like, well, you can't say that you're out yet then.
Yeah.
you know, and so like for me looking at that, I was just like, okay, I'm making a decision for myself right now. I'm not going to tell anybody, or, you know, I'm not going to come out and things like that. So I went 5 years.
So John, I'm sorry. I don't mean to get, because I know you're going to keep going. I want to roll the tape a little bit. And Julian has a question too.
Yeah,
but sure. When do you want to ask your question for Julian? Because I know I have a tendency to chit chat. Go ahead, Julian. I'm sorry.
So
new year, new you.
Exactly. I'm usually the one that doesn't really talk a lot, so I'm trying to like change that a little bit.
Yeah.
So backstory, I'm a huge Pittsburgh Steelers fan. Never been to Pittsburgh, never been to Pennsylvania, but I also know
like most Pittsburgh Steelers fans.
Dude.
Okay.
It's like Florida Gator fans. They like the colors because it matches everything. Anyway, go ahead, Julian. I'm done. I'm done. Go ahead.
Are you sure? Are you sure? Yeah, sure? I mean, can we? Okay.
Yeah. Cool.
And I understand Pittsburgh, Steel Town, everything very blue collared. I mean,
yes.
Knowing 90s. So, within even your friends at, you know, Penn State and everything, was the environment, meaning where you lived, the state in where you lived, was that also kind of a part of it? Because, you know, we talked about masculinity, and it doesn't get any more masculine than a steelwork.
Exactly. So
did that have a little bit, or maybe a lot, to play in as far as the indecision of everybody, whether they're going to come out or not?
Yeah, it definitely is a big influence. Living here, like you said, Julian, it's very blue collar, and you know, it's a steel town. So you've got all these masculine guys going to blue collar jobs, and I mean, which blue-collar, you know,
bars.
Yeah, exactly. So So I grew up in the suburbs, about 15 minutes from downtown Pittsburgh. So where I grew up, it really wasn't that much of an influence. But once you get closer to the city, obviously you have that, you know, masculine vibe. Like, okay, well, once you graduate high school, you're going to learn a trade job, and you're going to work in the mills, or, you know, do something like that. I never wanted to do that. So my decision, I grew up Catholic. So yeah.
You had all the carbs. Wow. Yeah. You had it all against you, man. I would have felt nice about coming out too.
Yeah. So I grew up Catholic. So, I mean, it says in the Bible that, you know, homosexuality is wrong, blah, blah, blah. We've all heard, you know, that stuff. Yeah, So, like, obviously, but that was
not
a big...
It's not one of the Ten Commandments.
It's true. That's
just
true. It's true.
I agree.
Go ahead.
All right.
But
if you need representation at the gates, let me know. I got your back.
All right, man. I appreciate that. But that definitely influenced my not coming out publicly. Yeah, exactly. So it really had not that much to do with my surroundings, where I live, things like that. It was more like, well, if you come out, you're going to hell, which now I know is, you know, BS, basically.
So let me ask you, when did you know that you were gay, John? Because I mean, I'm sure it's not an easy burden to carry. I just know, I have friends back in the 90s that were gay, and I do know I have one good friend that was openly gay, but she was a girl, and I feel like being, and I could be wrong because I'm not gay, but this is the way I see it. I feel like being gay but being female is a lot more accepting to people than a man, because men think lesbians are cool. They're like, oh, right. Girls, that's awesome.
Exactly.
You guys kiss? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, you know, like it's always like two girls have always been like, oh my God, for men. Like, it's just like a crazy thing. So it, to me, it was always, that was my first experience with a homosexual couple. And they were lesbian and they were like open. Like, this is back in 94, 95.
Oh,
and
wow.
In high school. Yeah. And I always thought that, like, I went to high school here in a small town in Flagler County in Florida. And it was such a, to me, it was nothing. I was like, all right, they're gay.
Yeah.
High five. But right. I never really realized how different it is for the other side of the, you know what I mean? So how does that, you tell me, I mean, I can go on forever.
Okay. Well, I'll start with your first question. Like, when did I know? Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things where I kind of, you know, like I talked about before, you dissociate feelings. So mm-hmm. like I had an inclination, when I was probably around 16, 17 years old. But again, at that time, it wasn't in my wheelhouse to be like, okay, here I am, you know, I'm out, I'm proud, I'm here. It doesn't work that way. So I came out at 28 years old, which is one of my gay friends told me that's very late to come out. Doesn't really matter to me. So between the time I started college and the time I graduated college, and I was in college for 5 years. So when I started college, I was just like, I'm not going to tell anybody. I don't care. It is what it is. So let's move on. So
okay, I got curious again, and I think it's important to ask the question because I think you kind of paves the way. So were you dating? Like, did you have a girlfriend at the time? Nothing. So like, you didn't have a girlfriend in high school. You didn't have a girlfriend in college. And you said you did an experiment in college either. So you weren't seeing any other men, anybody.
No.
You were just
nothing.
That's a lot, John. Like, especially for being like a teenage boy in your early 20s. Like, I remember me like hormonally raging over anything. Like, as I saw a girl walk by and I was like, oh, wow, look at that.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so like, how did you cope with that? Like, that's gotta be really mentally, you know, and not so much as the physical side, but that's when you know what I mean? Like, that's when you experiment, like you experience your first love, that puppy love, you get your heart broken, you know, you kind of get the ins and outs of dating. Like, you take it to the movies and TGIF, you take it, Fridays, you do things and you didn't do any of that. Like,
that had to be
really tough, man. Like, that's, it sounds really lonely. I'm not trying to label it.
Oh, no,
it sounds really lonely.
You're right. It definitely is. And I definitely self-sabotaged myself just for the fact that I didn't want any negative repercussions to come from other people. So I basically wrapped myself up in doing homework for college and, you know, doing extracurricular activities. And basically I did anything that I could do to occupy my time. I had a very close knit group of friends. We always, you know, you go out when you're in college, you go to bars, you go to, you know, concerts, you know, things like that. So I was basically going out every weekend, every night to, you know, just occupy my time. Like, hey, you want to go out to dinner? Sure. Or, you know, I go here. You know, like, I was basically trying to fill my time to not have to deal with the things that I was lacking.
So during these times, nobody ever, like questioned you, made fun of you. I mean, shit, I made fun of Julian all the time back in the day because he always fell in the friend zone when it came to girls. I mean, I still give him. I mean, it's true though. I
can't lie. I mean, it's yeah.
But you know, so none of your friends were ever like, what did your friends know? And they were just kind of respecting your space or.
So when I started to come out to my friends, basically the response I was getting from 99.9% of people was, oh, I already knew. We were just waiting for you to come out. And I was like, thanks.
You could have pushed that along a little bit.
Yeah, right. I was like, you could have helped me out like 5 years ago, you know, and things like that. But like, in a way, I'm kind of grateful for the way that it happened. Because it kind of let me do self reevaluations. Like, okay, like what do I want in a relationship? Do I, you know, am I attracted to anybody, you know, in my, you know, friend group? What is anybody else gay in my friend group? Mm-hmm. You know, like, and usually the answer to that last question is no. So, So you're basically on your own island. And you're looking out at everybody else who is paired up with somebody. And it's just like, okay, well, I'm the third wheel again, and we're going out to dinner. And, you know, yeah.
So now let's kind of fast forward a little bit, John. So at what point, so you mentioned that, okay, you gradually, you're like time release gay, coming out of the closet a little bit. No offense, but...
That's good.
Time release gay. We are totally getting hate mail, Julian. Thank you.
Hold on a second. I got a pattern for that too. At what point did you just say, you know what? This is my life. I'm not happy living this life, this like self-sheltered life. At what point, because you said until 28, so was it at 28 that you decided, you know what, fuck this. This is my life. Nobody's going to live it for me. Or were you, or was this, you know, was there a build up to this point?
So when I came out at 28, I never was like, you know, fuck it. I'm going to live my life. Who I am. It was more of a gradual thing. So it really didn't happen for me until after I turned 30. Because
So wait, so John, you did not date anybody until you were 30 years old?
Oh no, it happened way after that.
I got 100 million questions now. This is
So when I turned 30, I made a point for myself that, okay, I'm not going to live, you know, in this bubble that I have set up for myself up to this point. So I actively started, you know, trying to date and things like that, you know.
So let me ask you this. So what does trying to date look like? As 30, because like, you know, like I felt like,
yeah, hold on, I could answer that question. Backstory, I've been divorced 2 times, been married 3 times. So at 30, I know exactly what trying to date looks like.
Yeah,
but I already like, had, you know,
for me, I made a lot of mistakes, you know, through my 20s. Like, you know, I had my heart broken. I broke a lot of hearts, you know, I've done a lot of stupid things in between, you know, like that's gotta be really tough, John. Like, I mean, like trying to, especially like 30. So you were like dating during the internet time where there's social media and match.com and people swiping to the left and the right. Like you jumped into a time of love where it was almost like formulated love at this point. Yeah. Right. Because now it's, yeah. Now it's, I mean, if for the most part, it's acceptable to be openly gay, right? You know, I'm sure there's still there's still assholes and idiots out there that are ignorant and care too much about nothing. But, you know, now you're looking for happiness. You're looking for a partner. You're starting to date. What does that look like, man? Like that I would assume that I'm thinking funny. Like this could be like a movie. You know what I mean? But I, at the same time, I'm like, this has got to be really serious, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to lie. It sucks. Because like you said, I hate dating in general, anymore, because it's almost like a job interview. You go, you meet this person, and what do? You ask them the questions. Well, where do you work? Okay, that's great. And what do you like to do? Okay, well, so do I. You know,
check that.
Yeah.
How many job interviews have you been at the end of it? You might end up naked, but I mean, I got where you're going.
Yeah, I mean, so I signed up on this online dating site, OkCupid. I was probably about 32 at this point. So after a couple weeks,
the timeline keeps getting longer.
Yep. Have communication with this one guy, and he's like, hey, you want to go out to Starbucks for coffee? And so we go and meet, and he lays everything out on the table, like everything that he's going through. So what I found out after this first meeting was he's an addict, he's an alcoholic, and he just got out of jail. And
hey, so, at least you were diving the right way in. Like you were, that's who you were supposed to be dating when you were 18.
Yeah, right. So I just want to point out here that I have a degree in social work. Mm-hmm. So the social worker in me kind of kicks in as I'm driving home from this, you know, first date, I guess we'll call it. So I'm like, I need to figure out where this goes. Because if I don't take a chance, I'm going to be single forever. That's basically how I, you know, kind of said to myself, oh, let's do this. So after a couple more dates and things like that, he, you know, says, you know, do you want to go together? And, you know, let's date. And I was like, yeah, sure. Why, you know, I'm totally open to possibilities at this point. Mm-hmm. In the back of my head, I'm like, you don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. Because he's got a lot of baggage and, you know, but the heart wants what the heart wants, right? So,
and I get it. I mean, at that point in life, you know, you're like relationship colorblind because all you see is green flags, but you know.
Yeah. So October, we got together in August of that year. So in October, I was working as a teacher's assistant, and I was in my classroom one day, and like our method of communication throughout the day was texting. Mm-hmm. I usually would text him in the morning, he would text me back, and then it would just go on from there. So I texted him one morning, I didn't get anything all day. And so I was like, okay, what's going on? You know, should I be worried? And then I get a call at 5 o'clock that night from his sponsor through AA. And he's like, I just want you to know that Dale, your boyfriend, has gotten himself arrested. I was like, okay, so I hang up the phone and I'm like, what the hell do I do with this now? You know, like, where do I go from here? So for the next couple of weeks, he's sending me letters from the jail to my house pleading, you know, don't break up with me and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I love you so much and things like that. And, you know, I'm still living at home at this point. So,
John, have you thought about writing a book?
Yes,
because this is not boring, John.
You just wrote the typical Puerto Rican woman. He's laughing because he's Puerto Rican and I'm married to one. So I understand. So I'm going to stop right there for a moment. So, you know, John, we talked about, you know, offline, off the air and all that stuff, you know, that all three of us are big proponents. Obviously you're a wellness coach and everything, you know, we like to focus on that whole mental health aspect, especially with the men, everything that we don't like, everything that you've gone through. Okay. I mean, that's got to really fuck with your mental health, whether you realize it, accept it or not. But did you ever go down kind of like a spiral, I guess, and maybe to the point where you had to have some sort of a professional intervention? I mean, you're a social worker, so you kind of I'm pretty sure you were pretty good at you know, checking off the signs. But I mean, like in my case, you know, I've always been very open about my depression and, you know, getting treatment and having to go on medication or anything like that, recognizing those signs because of the fact that I've gone through it. But everything that you've been through, I mean, obviously you have that little bit of a background. Did at any point where you're like, okay, so maybe I should go see like a brain wrangler, or were you kind of like, F it, let me muscle through it, because I'm a man from Pittsburgh and I go downtown.
Yeah, exactly. So probably about in my mid-20s, I started noticing little bouts of anxiety. And that was pre-coming out. And that probably had a lot to do with my mental state at that point. So when I started dating this guy, my anxiety went through the roof. So my anxiety went through the roof. I actually changed jobs from education, and I started working in a hospital as a physical therapy aide. So I remember one of the first weeks I was there, somebody corrected me on, you know, some sort of protocol that I had to do. And they were very nice about it, things like that. But when you're dealing with anxiety, somebody can say something totally innocent to you and you just kind of break, which is what I had happened. So I had my first anxiety attack, and I never had experienced something so horrific before. I mean, I was crying, I was hyperventilating, and you know, I had pain in my chest, and I literally thought I was going to die. So they sent me home, and so I came home, and I kind of thought about, okay, I need to figure out this relationship, because if it's going to have some hope of working, we both need to recognize, you know, things that we need to work on to make it better. So I sat down with my boyfriend at the time, and I'm like, look, I love you, but I can't keep going through these occasions where I don't know where you are, who you're with, what you're doing, if you're, you know, dead somewhere, or if you're back in jail, or, you know, things like that. I had a really, really great friend of mine. Her name's Erica. She is a child of an alcoholic. So she grew up and she basically taught herself and trained herself how to deal with addictive behaviors. So she was kind of my point person on how to, you know, what do I do if this happens? And how do I, you know, move forward with the relationship if he's not willing to do what I'm asking him to? So I met with her umpteenth times during the relationship. And it got to the point where he started using drugs and he OD'd in my basement. Which was the final straw for me. And I even told him, I'm like, I can't do this for my mental health, my physical health. I just can't do this. So we stayed together for 3.5 years. It was the hardest 3.5 years I ever have lived through. And I'm including my illness in that. So I get a text message 2 years ago from his ex-boyfriend before me. And he basically opened up the message with, "Have you heard from him?" And I was like, "The last I heard, he moved to Seattle. He started dating and blah, blah, blah." He's like, "Well, I just want you to know that he passed away last night." Jesus. And I was like, "What?" And, you know, like, and he was very blunt about it. He's like, "Oh, he passed away." And I'm like, "Thank you. So like, now what do I do with this? You know, like, how do you grieve somebody that you haven't talked to in probably about 3-4 years? And then you have all these people, friends and family saying, "Are you okay? Do you need anything?" And it's just like, I don't know how to feel. Because I've been so out of, you know, talking to this person that it's just, it's not one of the, I can't be sad because I
out of sight, out of mind, but I'm sure at the same time, you know, I mean, this was your first boyfriend.
Right. Exactly. Right?
Your first love. Like, right. I mean, regardless, everybody has that special place in their heart for that. That first, you know what I mean? That like, you learn so much from that. And, you know, it's difficult, right? You have this loss, I'm sure in your mind, A, you were like, this can't be real, right? The denial stage. And then you go, then you have to, then I'm sure after you had that conversation, I mean, how do you pay respects to somebody that you left off on a bad foot, right? It was
exactly.
I'm sure that like most, like with most addicts, the last conversation is never a good conversation, right? Sure. So, you know, John, you've been through a lot, John. I mean, to have you to be watching you and you telling me this story, and I don't know how the hell you haven't broke down. I mean, Julian and I are like straight fucking tears sometimes when we're talking about certain things. Like, I have a high level of respect for you, man. Like, I don't think a lot of people can cope because. You know, for listeners out there and people who are watching, you should definitely follow John's social media. He has it tagged on the screen now. But I mean, you're a very uplifting person. You're very positive, but very realistic positivity, which I like. I hate those people that think the sun shines out of their ass 24/7 and nothing goes wrong because you control everything. Fuck you, pal. I think it's admirable how you carry yourself. And I think this would be a good question to ask. So now you're a life coach. And I don't know, man. I think you're a highly qualified life coach because you have had some stuff, man. Like
it's funny now because 2021, John, I could have used you. When, you know, 2021, Julian could have used you back in 1995 because funny enough, my first love broke up with me and then later she came out. So I was kind of like, okay, was it me? Was it?
Yeah,
it was totally you.
It was totally me. Yeah.
It was totally you.
It was totally me. So.
So what made you jump? Okay, so you had this really tragic experience. I'm sorry for your loss. I know that you said that it wasn't part of your life, but he was part of your life. I mean, it is what it is. And losing anybody to addiction is not easy.
No, exactly.
So was this shortly after, I mean, was this after this loss is when you felt like you needed to make a difference in other people's lives and move into that role of being a life coach?
So I've always been a helper. I've always been a counselor, a guide. That's just kind of how my personality is. And it always has been, even since I was a little kid. I've always wanted to be the people pleaser. I've always wanted to be the fixer of people's problems. My friends in college, they always came to me with their shit. They always was like, what do you think about what should I do? And, you know, things like that. So, I mean, this whole, like, trying to help people, this is nothing new for me. I've been doing this my entire life. Because, I mean, it's kind of like you said, like, I have a very unique history that I have
we'll
a
go
lot.
With that. We'll go with unique.
Yeah, sure. Whatever adjective you've got for it is fine. But I've got a lot of life experience that I can draw on to be able to give different perspectives on how to help people move forward in their lives and things like that. It's funny, when I got my personal trainer certification and I started working for the company that I still am with now. When you work as a personal trainer, it's almost like you're a bartender, because when you first meet with somebody, depending on where their mental state is, they're going to tell you a lot of shit that you don't ask them to tell you. Yeah, so I got people, you know, telling me that I've got depression. I had one person who said, I sat in the parking lot in my car for 45 minutes until I got the, you know, balls to come in here and meet you, because I thought you were going to yell at me about my eating habits and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I was just like, you know, it's one of those things where, like, I always look at myself as, I'm not a drill sergeant. I'm not going to work you until you can't do anything else, unless that's what you want. I'm more of the, you've got an issue, but there's something holding you back from being able to achieve these goals. We need to look at what that is before we can move forward with going forward with workout plans and dieting goals. Because if you're not in the right headspace, it's not going to work. And going through, you know, my personal training job there, and then now management, which is a whole other animal that I'm still getting used to. Orlando, you know about management. How long have you been in management?
20-ish years?
20? Oh, yeah.
18 years, actually. Not 20 yet. I'm not that old. 18.
Regardless, it's
babysitting.
Basically. And yeah. So this is my third year of management, and I'm learning a lot. I'm learning what I don't like, but overall, for me, it's about helping my staff, trying to be, you know, the best they can be in their job roles, and plus interacting with the gym members. A lot of them, again, they just kind of open up and they're like, well, I have cancer, or I'm dealing with, you know, this issue or that issue. And I'm like, I need to go research life coach certifications, because I've got a lot of freaking life experience, and I think that
I would agree with you
that I can, you know, help people in a different way, other than just health and fitness. But I'm still going to make that a focus.
Absolutely. So, I joke about the babysitting part with management. I mean, it is a part of it, but essentially you're a life coach when you're in management, right? Because you're playing with self-discovery. You're trying to teach them new skill sets. You're trying to teach them skill sets that some of them will never learn.
Right.
You know, and you're trying to take maybe someone who might not fit into a scenario and make it work. You know, it's a multifaceted
right
position. It's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, you know, you kind of do. I mean, I'm sure as a manager, I mean, people come into your office and diarrhea the mouth and they tell you the same thing. They'll be like, I thought you were going to yell at me. I just found out that my two baby moms are knocked up again. Like, they just tell you stuff where you're like,
yeah.
So let's talk about work and how are you going to do today? Or do you need to pay off, you know? So I have a question. You're a life coach, personal trainer. Do you find that it's difficult as being a gay man to be a coach, like with your male customers? Like, are they apprehensive with talking to you, or do you find that maybe they're more open to talking to you? I'm just curious, because, you know, I know back in the day, if you met somebody who was gay, it was could be very
selfish. So I don't wear my gayness on my sleeve like it's like some people. So it's not something that's outwardly obvious. Mm-hmm. Unless the person knows me, you know, knows about that part of myself. But quite honestly, I think most of the male clients that I've trained, they've been more receptive than female clients that I've had. I think it goes back to the whole, and I hate the term toxic masculinity because I don't think there's such a thing. I just think that there's a lot of wounded men in this country who need to deal with their feelings, but that's another talk. There's a lot of guys who I've trained who we'll go through and we'll be working out, things like that. You know, you strike up conversations about, you know, personal things in your life. And a lot of times they just want to talk. And they want to vent about, you know, their girl or their wife or, you know, their kids or, you know, whatever they're going through, because they can't get, you know, the response or the justification from their partner or whoever it is that they're living with in their situation. I think because of my demeanor and everything that I've been through, again, it's easier for me to be like, bro, have you thought about it this way instead of doing it this way? And, you know, okay, weight loss and fitness aside, let's talk about this, because you obviously are telling me because you want to, you know, pick my brain about
it. I find it interesting because you saying that you know, you find men being more receptive than women. It's weird. Like you said, like, there's no such thing as toxic masculinity, but you mentioned that it's just a lot of wounded men out there. And it's weird. Like, right. So like Julian and I, and I don't know if you've ever heard our first episode that we talked about our mental health and our depression, you know, when Julian and I first sat down and started talking about this project and doing whatever, we weren't talking about mental health. We weren't talking about illness or anything like that. We just wanted to be two guys chucking it up, laughing, making fun of people. And you know, it came with Julian getting a scare that he thought he might have had cancer, and he knew that I had went through cancer, and I was really open about it. And we started talking, and we're having these conversations, and all of a sudden, you know, I told him, I'm like, you know, all I can prepare you for is that cancer is the easy part.
Right.
You know, because there's drugs, there's rehab, there's key therapies that are good. No doctor ever prepares you or preps you for what life is like after cancer.
Exactly.
And, you know, the level of depression that I went through and the anxiety that I went through during and after. And, you know, like when I was talking to Julian about it, he was really quiet for almost the entire time that I was telling him the story, to the point where I'm like, you still there? And he was kind of like, like, dude, I didn't know. Like, I don't see you as that person, like being depressed. Like, I would never like do social media or whatever. Like, you went so headstrong with this. And, but then he opened to me about his depression and how, and things that he does. And like, it's crazy because I feel like when you hear, so this is why we want to talk to people like yourself, why we have a podcast like this, because we feel that if it's just one person that we get to have that conversation about mental health, and it'll spark them to have a conversation with somebody else, you know, and it's truly life-saving. It's I felt, right, Julian? Like, I felt like it was like a relief, like a weight off my shoulders that I was able to have. I mean, I still haven't had that level of a conversation with my own mother, you know what I mean? And to have the conversation with a friend who we were like bar buddies to start with. Like, I mean, you want to talk to you about the epitome of masculinity. Like, that's what, how we met was clubs, bars, fightings, and chicks, like, and boots. Right. Like, that was our life for a long time. Yeah. And, you know, to have that conversation, I think men are, it's easier for once another man to see a man to see another man shed a tear or share his story, how quickly that water, that trickle down effect starts to happen. Like, oh, well, I went through that too. Oh my God, I didn't know that. So I think it's, right. There's definitely truth to what you're saying, that it's just a bunch of wounded men out there, or either that, or they just don't know, you know?
Right. And then the other thing about it is it's also, and we talk about it a lot, it's a generational thing also.
Yeah.
Because I have been very, very, very vocal about how I feel about this current generation, as far as how I feel that they're soft. But at the same time, you know, I commend them because they're very open about their emotions. I'm talking about the generation in general, but also I'm talking about the men in this generation, you know,
right.
But they're a lot more open, to the point that I wish men in general were just that open, because I think a lot of problems would be resolved if men would just be a little bit more open with, you know, their emotions and how they feel. And I definitely give props to this generation, because I think they're spearheading this, I guess, this evolution of men actually being emotional creatures and being able to display it, being able to show it. Because, I mean, that's one of the things that, you know, it's, you can say it jokingly, but you know, that's one of the things that separates men from women in general, because women are in tune and open about their feelings. That's why you don't really hear too many cases about a man leaving a woman and then she goes off, cuts off his head, and he's floating in the Hudson. But you do hear that about men.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. So, it's just one of those things where, like, and like, it's kind of like you said, Julian, where it's more of a generational thing. So like, when we were growing up, because I think we're all around the same age. Mm-hmm. So whatever, but you're still around the same age. We'll say
we're contemporaries.
So when we were coming up, like we were taught you're a guy, you don't cry, don't show, you know, your softer side, things like that. Like, for me, like, my dad is one of the most level-headed guys I think I know. He would always encourage me to think for myself, not like, he never kind of conformed to the whole, I guess, John Wayne types of the old school masculinity that they had back in the 50s and 60s. And my dad was a military guy. He was in the Air Force for 4 years. So he went that route. He fits the masculine stereotype in that way. And then I come along And it's like, okay, well, you've got yourself a gay son. So what are you going to do with that? So for people who are, you know, in who are like in their early 20s now, it's kind of like there's this revolution to kind of normalize mental health, which is awesome. And mental health for guys, more specifically, because our suicide rates are higher. Our depression and anxiety rates are through the roof. We are the most addicted and in debt society ever that has ever been. So we have to find ways of, you know, getting these feelings out to get some sort of relief or kind of numb the discomfort, because that's what we're doing right now. We're numbing. We're not getting rid of these negative feelings.
There's been a lot of numbing over this last year.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And Orlando, I know you were talking to John Foley about meditation. And I am a huge advocate of, sit yourself in a room and, you know, minus the yoga pants, Julian. And
it's not that. It's not that. No, no. Hey, there's nothing wrong with yoga pants. I might be 41, but you know, I still got an ass. But the thing is that we've talked to so many of our guests that talk about meditation, and Orlando has been on me to, hey, meditate. Even this, and I'm just like, I don't know what it is. I cannot relax that way for whatever reason.
So the thing with meditation is that it doesn't have to be relaxing. I think that's what you need to get out of your head. Like, I try to tell people all the time, like, yes, absolutely. Like, I meditate before bed. Sometimes I meditate. This office, like where I podcast, is where I work during the day too. So when I sit down, I meditate 5-10 minutes. I really haven't gotten any longer than that. I'm not like any type of a guru or whatever, but like, I think it's more about self. Oh, I'm really big on self-awareness, right? So like, if I'm doing something wrong, or if I feel a certain way, or I reflect a lot on conversations. So if I have a conversation with somebody and I feel like it doesn't go right, I always go back to the conversation. I'm like, hey, listen, I thought about it. Boom. I think that's what made me a successful manager for so many years, because I've always been able to go back to my team and be like, all right, maybe you have a point. Let's look at it your way, whatever the case may be. But like with a lot of the biggest thing I think that's wrong with everybody, men, women, gay, straight, culturally, the whole nine yards, is nobody thinks about them, right? We're taught in love that you're supposed to make somebody else happy, no matter what, at all costs, right? Right? What is it? Like, happy wife, happy life. Like, I get it. Yes, that has some credence, but She cannot be happy unless I'm happy.
Right.
Right.
Happy house.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right. So like the man up movement, Julian. Man, here with like this partnership that I have with Julian, we both have to be happy, and I can't always be trying to make everybody happy. There's got to be hard conversations about, hey, we kind of suck at life. Let's try to change this around. Or I need to be happy. I need to be stronger, and I need to wake up and want to be alive. Right. Like so I'm very big on self-awareness. So like when I'm meditating, for me, it kind of gives me a mental and physical check, right? Cause it gives me 10 minutes of peace that I can breathe. I calm myself down, and I kind of just check throughout my body what hurts, what's uncomfortable, you know. Do I have a headache? Why do I have a headache? Is it because I have tension in the back of my neck? And I've gotten it down to where I could really calm my heart rate by almost 20 points in 10 minutes of breathing. Even when I exercise and I'm on the bike and I'm going full tilt, I've learned how to manage my heart rate by just simply breathing, because it's just the exercise of self-awareness, because I know, right? So, you know, do I wear yoga pants? Yes, I do. Do I, you know, do, you know, I cannot sit, I can't sit Indian style because I'm super inflexible. So when I meditate, I'm usually in a chair.
Yoga pants are the bacon of clothing. That's just,
I don't listen. The best thing that ever happened was athleisure wear for me because I'm in joggers, sweatpants 24/7, especially with COVID now, and sometimes yoga pants. But sometimes my wife's like, the fuck are you wearing? I'm like, I'm comfortable.
Are those mine?
Are those mine? Yeah, right. They'd be like shorts on me. but yeah, I think meditation is it's important. I think it's a skill set that a lot of people can learn. It's something simple, especially in today's environment where everybody thinks they're right.
Right.
Everybody's opinion is the right way. Everybody's a politician. Everybody's a fucking doctor. Everybody's a space engineer. You know, I always tell, you know, despite what I say on this show or people come at me, what I say on the show or even on social media, or if I stir the shit elsewhere, you know, I always ask the question, well, what would you do? You know, like, what do you feel like? And then that always gives them pause because they're like, well, you don't have an answer either. So how do we get to this? So, you know, I think by giving yourself some time to learn what makes you happy and then rethinking conversations that go in your head, you know, whether you be it through meditation or through just sitting down and thinking about it, I think it goes a long way. It's a big stress reliever for me.
Absolutely.
So I have a super profound thought, and this comes from experience.
Oh,
so,
shit. Hold on. I'm bracing myself for a profound thought. I don't know what I'm going to do with this dude, Julian, in 2021.
All right. So, John. So,
yeah.
A lot of us may or may not know that friend, family, loved one that is in a similar situation as you were growing up, closeted, not coming out. And then in some cases, kind of like you said, everybody was like, yeah, we knew, we were just waiting for you. I mean, how do you drag them out? No, that's not what I'm trying to say, but how would, from the experience, you did mention that nobody was like bullying to you or anything like that. It was just like a personal choice. But, you know, what kind of advice would you give to somebody who, you know, let's say they do have that, you know, friend, family member, loved one, and they kind of know they have that idea, they have that feeling, but don't want to be like, hey, I know, you know, let's talk about it. You know, how would somebody go about kind of like, I guess maybe making them feel safe, encouraging kind of like some, hey, it's okay. You know, because I know sometimes the stigma, especially with the loved ones, a little bit rough.
Right. So I'm just going to put a disclaimer here. I am in no way a certified therapist or every, you know, anything like that.
Julian gets all the hate mail anyway, so it's all right. Go ahead.
So this is just based on my personal experience. But anyway, obviously you never want to go up to that person and be like, I know, man, and it's okay.
Come on, you know, right? Yeah, exactly.
It's that person's own personal journey. Like, they have to find it within themselves to make that decision to, you know, unburden themselves, come out, you know, do everything thereafter. But for the other family members, I mean, it's just one of those things, man, where you just have to be, open and available. If they would ever come to you and be like, hey, can I talk to you about something? Obviously, you know, like, I've made hundreds of gay jokes for years, even before I came out, which, I mean, now, I mean, says a lot about my mental state at the time, but that's that's neither here nor there. But you want to be open. You want to be very supportive. And if they don't, if they're not ready to come out to you, but they're trying to have this conversation, obviously that's going to be very hard for you to do. Especially if you already have some sort of inclination that, okay, they might be this way or they might be feeling this way. It's one of those things where you don't, like the negativity, you have to squash that because the more threatened they feel by your response, the more apt they are to do harmful things to themselves. They might cut themselves. They might start doing drugs or alcohol or, you know, things worse than that. Or, you know, if it gets that bad, they might go the suicide route, God forbid. But it's just one of those things where, you know, you need to kind of look at it from that person's perspective. You know, how would I want to have them, you know, if I came to them with this problem, how would I want them to be, how would I want them to be treating me? You know, it's just one of those things where like there's no rubric for it, which is, you know, which is hard. Because everybody's different. Everybody responds different to things other people say. And, like, that's the thing about society today. You say one wrong thing and it's all over for that person. Cancel. So, yeah, cancel culture. So, and we've got huge mental health issues that we need to start recognizing. And the cost of mental health care, it's insane. So a lot of people aren't getting help for the stuff they need, but just be open to be talking to that friend or that family member. That's really the best advice that I can kind of give right now.
As we always say, communication, right?
Just absolutely
reach out, talk to somebody and listen.
Yeah. And listen. Yeah, for sure.
So, guys, I think it's a good stopping point. I know we've been going on for a little bit now. So, John, please tell everybody how to get a hold of you in the locally, if you want, in the Pittsburgh area, on social media, and when and where again for your podcast.
Okay, so the Man Alive podcast. So I'm still working out the schedule, but I will have all that information available. My handle on Instagram is @ManAlivePodcast2021. So you can always shoot me a DM if you have any questions concerning about what we discussed here or topics that you might want me to cover in my podcast later on down the line. But in regards to the locals in the Pittsburgh area, you can always find me on Facebook if you just search John Schessler Jr. My dad is on there too, so you always have to put the suffix on the end. but you can also look at my men's life coach and health and wellness page at just search my name, men's coach. You should be able to get it for the search results. And you can always email me. My email is jjspt7@gmail.com.
Awesome. We'll make sure that we plug all that in the show notes for this episode on YouTube and on the podcast. So, John, thank you so much for being on the show. It was really insightful to have you. I'm glad to have you as a friend of the show, for real. I would love to have you back on the show in the future. If you need any support with your podcast, let Julie and I know, because we've done all the growing pains in the podcasting world. It sucks, but we learned, and we don't mind sharing.
Definitely will be hitting you guys up. Don't worry.
Yeah, absolutely. I have some other really cool ideas that hopefully I could come up with come into fruition in 2021. And I think we might have you part of that for sure. We'll definitely send you an invite when that comes along.
Yeah, please do. I always love collaborating, so that would be awesome.
Absolutely. Well, guys, everybody, for those who listen live on our broadcast, thank you so much for being here. We greatly appreciate it. Don't forget, hit the like button, subscribe to the podcast, give us a share. Tell your friends. But if you're going to go ahead and listen to us on the audio side, you can listen to us on any You can listen to us on any podcasting platform.
Curse of the outro.
So you can listen to us any podcasting platform. We're on Apple Podcasts. We're on Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts. We're on all of them. Just simply search the Invincibly Broken Podcast. Please, please, please help us out with that algorithm. Hit the like button. Subscribe to it on the on your favorite podcasting player. There's links right there. You can come check us out on our website, www.invinciblybroken.com. We have all our links there as well for easy find for you guys, and as well as our archive of libraries of our past episodes. Also, you can follow us on social media. Just simply search Invincibly Broken on Instagram and on Facebook. And if you want to follow me personally, you can follow me at Invincibly_Orlando.
And if you want to follow me personally, you could follow me at Invincibly_Julian.
Guys, till next time, thank you again for everything. Enjoy the new year. Let's pretend the last 7 days of the new year haven't happened, starting over as of this episode drop. Thank you. Ciao. And we'll see you all soon.
Thanks, guys. Have a good night.
Thank you, John. Good night, you crazy yinzer.